Hello, my name is Raj Mehta. Welcome to Richard Lehman Discusses EBM. I'm joined today, as always, with Richard. How are you today, Richard?
Fine, thanks, Raj. I think we ought to rename this series, really. We should say Raj Mehta and Richard Lehman Discuss EBM.
I'm okay with how it is now. Well, I'm excited for today's topic because we're going to be discussing something a little bit unusual for a podcast. We're going to be discussing websites and how to use them during patient consultation. Is that right, Richard?
Sort of, yeah. I don't think we can run through a whole lot because there are so many. And the one I'd like to concentrate on is called gpevidence.org, which you can get up if you're listening to this with a PC or a phone handy, but obviously not if you're in a car or a clinic. And this brings us on to where these things are actually used. Are they to be used in clinics or are they to be used for homework or whatever? The websites vary a great deal. The one that I'm talking about follows from the conversation that we had about type 2 diabetes last. We broke that off because I'd already gone on a great deal on the subject, and I wanted to move on from there. And in fact, I mentioned in that podcast that there was this new site which provided a new way of thinking about the chronic management of type 2 diabetes. But without further ado, I'll go back to Raj and ask him what sort of websites he already uses when he's trying to consult with a patient with a chronic condition.
Yes, technology is at the core of how we practice modern medicine, beginning with me using a computer to record patient notes and an electronic record, to doing online communication with patients, to labs and results, and so on. Of course, an important part of trying to be a better physician is using available tools to improve the practice of our care. So most of us are familiar with point of care tools or POC tools. So these are often reference officers we can use in the moment or in between consultation rooms where we're perhaps looking up information, whether it's drug dosing or first line treatment therapies, or just information that can better inform us so that we can do a better job caring for the patient in front of us. So that's one important part of it. Another aspect of using technology with patient care is engaging in both patient education and in shared decision-making. And this is a little bit tricky because there are different things we can do, from printing out handouts to patients, to writing out instructions to them, to using visual and oral discussion to try and help educate patients, and different strategies to try and ensure patients understand our explanations and we're sharing goals. And then the harder part beyond that is, how do you get the patient engaged in shared decision-making, especially for decisions that are very numerically based or involve a lot of data? And that can be very tricky. And there is some research and some evidence out there, but the reality is this is still an open frontier. And I think all of us are looking for better tools to improve upon this process. And potentially the gpevidence.org website is one such tool that I think can be very helpful here.
Yeah, you say you print out information for patients and so on. So you assume that they prefer print as a mode of information. And you too prefer print as a mode of information in some circumstances, don't you? Do you use UpToDate, for instance?
Yeah, so UpToDate is a good reference for when I'm trying to find new information. It does have some information on there about patient information for handouts. And then there are other references, like Elsevier has a library of patient information handouts where I may have stored things from places that I like. And I would say I wouldn't necessarily espouse saying printouts are my favorite way, but you know, I trained over 10 years ago and certainly printing something out and handing it to a patient seemed empowering. That I'm not just verbally telling you something, but I'm also handing you something that you can read, or I can add custom directions to it. But you know, that 2010 and 2000 is very different from 2023. Now we have the internet, now everyone has a cell phone, and perhaps handing people patient handouts is no longer the best way. Now it's maybe a QR code or a website they go to, or a message I send them in the portal.
Well, I think the act of handing something to a person is a very symbolic thing, which dates back to before the dawn of time, really. If you give something to a person, then you make peace with them. And this is what Captain Cook did when he went around the Pacific Island. He always made sure that he had something in his hand as a gift for hostile islanders. And then they'd start trusting him. So there's something to be said for it. And in fact, in shared decision-making, the act of handing over a piece of paper to the patient to look at and to list the things that they may wish to ask about, I think is still quite a powerful thing. And it's what made Glyn Elwin design his option grids, which still have a lot of use, I think. But we have a rich economy of different information sources now, and which is the one that you think doctors and patients use most?
So for me, practicing in the US, I think, you know, UpToDate is probably the most common reference source that people like to use. There's several others. And then for patients, to be honest, I think the first thing that comes up on a Google search, you know?
Yes. Absolutely. A Google search. That's what you do, actually, isn't it? I mean, yes. Even if you want to look up a rare form of lymphatic tumor, you might go to Google first. You probably get a better review of it there than if you went to PubMed, for instance. Quicker, anyway. So, and the first thing you might get on Google is what?
Oh, I might get a Wikipedia article. Or
precisely,
consult, yeah. Or something like that.
Yeah, you'd get Wikipedia most, or you'd look for Wikipedia if you, mm-hmm. if you didn't get it first. You might get a Mayo Clinic handout or some other source. I don't know how Google prioritizes these things, but Wikipedia seems to me to be the common resource used by doctors and patients. If they've had a condition named to them by a doctor, the most likely thing is that they'll go out of the room and immediately fact check on what you've told them. I'm sure that's true. Yeah. I mean, there are more mobile phones now, and I think I've said this before, than there are flushing toilets in the world. So people are going to check what you say. And if they don't check it online, they'll check with their relatives or they'll check with somebody else and they will look it up online. And so it goes on. And of course, there's an awful lot of misinformation as well. Mm-hmm. But Wikipedia, fortunately, still exists as a fabulous free resource that's fact checked very carefully. And one of my friends spends most of his time doing that up on a Canadian mountain. So I think Wikipedia probably is the place where we should concentrate our efforts if ever we want a common source of information for doctors and patients to share, because it's where they'll go anyway. Now, I say that, and I'm actually talking about a completely different website now that was specifically designed for British GPs. Now, it so happens that it was designed and built by a friend of mine, and it's taken him about 10 years. So I will mention him by name.
Yeah, so I think this is a good point, because I wanted to ask you, you know, who is this individual and what motivated him to start this website and to work on this project?
Yeah, his name is Julian Treadwell. And he's now in middle life. He was a GP by choice, but like many of us in middle life, he decided that he wasn't doing the job as well as he might, given this wonderful thing called evidence-based medicine that had come along. So how does evidence-based medicine often express the size of a treatment effect?
So this is one of the biggest problems we have, that when it comes to how something works, we tend to presume an all or nothing effect, like it works or it doesn't. So EBM has introduced this lovely concept of the number needed to treat, which is one way to represent effect size in absolute terms. The idea being that perhaps if we give a medicine to 10 people, on average, 1 in 10 might benefit over a set period of time and so on. But it's conceptually difficult. I know our statistician friends don't like that. They prefer us just to use normal absolute rates or risk ratios or odds ratios. And certainly when we're discussing it with patients, it can be challenging to convey these effect sizes to them and how that affects decision making.
Yeah, I think it's often difficult for doctors as well. It does assume that the effects can be divided into yes or no. So it's a very black and white concept. It's also derived from populations. And patients are not populations, they're individuals, and therefore they want to know what will work for them. Moreover, most numbers needed to treat are quite large. If you say to someone, you may think an NNT of 9 is great, but a patient might say, well, that means that I've an 8 out of 9 chance or that I'm not going to actually get any benefit from this. And this particularly applies, of course, to long-term treatments. And then you have a question of NNT over how long a period, you know, over my lifetime, over the next 5 years, and so on. Mm-hmm. And where were all these NNTs to be found then, Raj?
Well, this is the challenging thing about them, because we don't know what they are for a population. You can only kind of try to figure it out what it might have been for a group of people in a study. And then if we're trying to generalize it to other individuals, you have to individualize it for each one of them, because everyone has a different starting baseline risk. And that means that these numbers will vary and change.
Yeah. But if you wanted to say to a patient, which you'll never do in real life, you have atrial fibrillation, I want to give you Sotalol. Where would you like on the NNT?
Oh, that'd be, yes. So it'd be very difficult. And so, you know, we have some risk scores that we try to use that have been created. And so these things, some of them are decision-making ones. Like for AFib, we have the CHADS-VAS, which will kind of tell us if we should start or not start a medication. But if I wanted to know the absolute risk or the number needed to treat for the absolute risk of having a stroke potentially, and the number needed to treat or giving a medication, I'd probably have to go back to a guideline or the original journal article, look at the exact, you know, risks, odd ratio, relative risk, and then use some kind of calibrated cohort data to try and figure out for them what their baseline risk was and try and convert it over. So it'd be quite cumbersome. And I'd be worried I'd be making mistakes along the way.
Yeah. They're on DIG and someone's decided to start an anticoagulant, and this is not actually going to happen, is it?
No. It's a nice abstract exercise for students on exams, but we really aren't doing this day to day for every patient in front of us.
And you could argue that we should, or you can argue that we never will. And both may be true. And so you've got the problem of real life. And in fact, there was a website set up some years ago in the States called VNNT. Did you know that?
Yes. Yeah.
And so in theory, you could go to that. And if your patient just happened to click into the right category and be generalizable to, then they might have an NNT attached to a treatment, which you would then have to explain is not that they are going to get 1/9 of a quantum of benefit, but that they are going to, they might be the 1 in 9 who benefits. So that in itself is going to take up a lot of your consultation. So it's again a little bit removed from real life. Mm-hmm. And this is where Julian started. He saw that there was this website, and yet in his heart of hearts, he felt that this was just not practical for daily use. And in fact, GPs in the UK were not using it. So he decided to see if he could devise a better kind of decision chart for doctors to use, not for patients to use, but for doctors to use. And if he could interest the organization called NICE in this. Now, NICE, as many listeners will know, is a UK organization which was set up 20 years ago, or slightly more than that now, and was supposed to issue authoritative guidelines with lots of public involvement on various medical conditions and their treatments. And so this seemed to fit in with their core mission very well, and it did, and they were very interested. But it never quite matured at that point, and we are talking about, I think, 8 years ago or so. NICE stood for the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. It now stands for the National Institute for Care and Excellence. But you get the general idea. It's supposed to be a one-stop shop for processing evidence in a way that doctors can use and increasingly share with patients. Okay. So I think, I hope I'm keeping you listening to this, because Julian has been beavering away ever since at making this a better site, and he's become more radical as time has gone on. And this is important, because individuals do become more radical with time, whereas institutions become more conservative with time. And it's very important that we do have some good new thinking, some really cutting edge thinking with a cutting edge. And this is what GP evidence is. And that's why I'm commending it so strongly.
Yeah. So
any further observations, Rog?
Yeah. So when I'm looking at this GP evidence site, I think one of the things that's nice is it's concise, and it has a few common issues that are important for preventative care, for decision making, where a lot of the underlying data, the absolute risk and need to treat, are sometimes unclear how that affects decision making. So on this website, he has atrial fibrillation, heart disease, CKD, COPD, heart failure, hypertension, lipids, and so on. And the data he's using and the recommendations are borrowed straight from your NICE guidelines, which is ideal, because if it's not based on guidelines, then we don't want to send people astray. And it's helpful in this atrial fibrillation example you gave, where if I have someone who I'm deciding whether or not to start anticoagulation on, I may be familiar with the CHA2DS2-VASc score, I may be using it, but this website is beneficial in the sense that not only does it give me the CHA2DS2-VASc, but it gives me a nice visual example using the Kato plot of how many people's baseline risk might exist and how many people might benefit from being on this medication. So it gives a nice visual representation of the number needed to treat, I think, which can be helpful for decision-making. It can help also elicit awareness in me as a provider, is, you know, what are the general kind of numbers I'm looking at? So I think there's a great value there in having that synthesized, and also in a website that's simple and elegant, and that it's just really dealing with some of the more common, you know, really patient-centered areas for decision-making in primary care.
Thanks for that. And let's just move one down to coronary heart disease, okay? With atrial fibrillation, Julian's decided to stick with stroke prevention largely, and in terms of anticoagulation, we're not rate control for symptomatic relief, but straight to the main issue. With coronary heart disease, you've got a broad definition, including a history of myocardial infarction, and presumably, and I haven't looked carefully, a history of angina or treatment with stenting. Now, if you could just you're on that now, aren't you, Raj? So what does it say there, treatment options?
So this is nice. They discuss lifestyle changes as well as medication. So there's looking at options of smoking cessation, Mediterranean diet, exercise-based cardiac rehabilitation, and then four medication options here, antiplatelets, statins, beta blockers, and ACE or ARBs.
So what's your immediate takeaway from that as you look at it? How do you rank those options?
Yeah, so, you know, as a provider, obviously, you know, I should be hopefully aware of all these things. And these are things I'm going to be discussing with patients, that these are the best medications, these are interventions, smoking cessation, better diet, super important. But sometimes, as we've discussed before, these effects are just listed in the abstract. Okay, you should stop smoking, you should take your antiplatelet, but what is the exact effect size? What's more important, the smoking or the antiplatelet? Does the patient understand? I'm just telling them this is important, but how dramatic is that importance, you know? And so on this website, you know, having that in front of me and having some visualizations with that, it's quite nice. And it kind of puts into context. And I have a gestalt that, you know, smoking cessation probably is a larger effect size than dietary changes, even though both are important. And sure enough, this website does a really good job giving that data directly as well as a source of information. So this is nice.
But it's, what hits you, of course, is that the first three are non-pharmacological interventions.
Mm-hmm.
Although you can give and should give pharmacological interventions to help people smoking if they need. You can't send them to the Mediterranean, unfortunately, but you can give them information about this fantasy object, the Mediterranean diet, which is rarely eaten in the Mediterranean, but has certain food components that we all regard as healthy and have been proved to improve the
process. Well, I think there's some contention about the quality of Mediterranean diet and the studies that are there. But dietary interventions are hugely important here.
Yeah. And basically, it's eat lots of fresh stuff and fruit and veg. And what else you eat probably doesn't matter all that much. It's an emphasis on the healthy elements, not on the so-called unhealthy bits. And then rehab. Again, it's for those that those studies have quite a large selection bias to and dropout rates and so on. And then you come on to the things that we're all familiar with. If we jump to statins, you can press on a plus there and it gives you the benefits in very simple terms. The number needed to treat, which is as much as 17, relative risk reduction, which is 40%. And those two figures don't seem to make much sense at a glance. But if you look over at the Cates charts, yeah. Chris Cates invented these smiley face charts, by the way, that's what we're referring to. Green means good. Yellow means not so good, red means dead.
No.
You'll see that there's a definite difference in the number who end up dead after a given period of time, which in this case is 5 years. So it's all dead easy stuff. And although it's meant for doctors, it could easily be used by patients, because whenever understanding amongst doctors has been compared to that of patients, there isn't a great deal of difference in most studies. So these would easily be turned into shared decision-making tools. They're just waiting for that to be done.
I do have to make two points of caution here. Mm. So the one is that, you know, every individual's their baseline absolute risk, and thus the risk reduction will vary a little bit. And so on this website, they're just static numbers and examples they're using. So these are generic examples of an average patient, and it may not necessarily be, it's not specific to the patient who may be looking at this. So, you know, if this Kato plot of statin says 40% relative risk reduction, which is great, And then they mentioned something like a 6% absolute risk reduction. So in this example, that's true. But for each patient, that number will be different depending on where they're starting from. So we want to be cautious that patients don't look at this and just think, oh, this exact number and this exact smiley face applies to me, because there will be some variability there. And then I think just the second thing to be careful of is that, as helpful as the number needed to treat is, and this probably deserves its own podcast, there are limitations and challenges with using number needed to treat in EBM that we also have to discuss.
Totally. And I am sure that that Julian would be very happy to discuss those points with us, in fact, because I know he's given them a great deal of thought. So perhaps we'll bring him on in a future podcast. In fact, what you could say is that this shows that risk individuation should be done before we use these tools, basically. And we're talking about another process which can be simply done through modern, not AI, but just basic computation, just a simple fitting in of data that we've already got on the patient record into a calculation of risk. And then we can get accurate figures for each individual as far as we can extrapolate them from the trial. So this isn't by any means a destination tool, but it's probably, I would say, better than most of what we have at the moment in terms of being practically useful at one click. I don't know how you feel about that, Raj.
I think every tool that can help, you know, better visualize data and decisions that we're making are important. So I think this is great. There are two fundamental things here. One is that we need to do the shared decision making. One is just the general data, like where are your risks? And then how does your risk change with interventions? Because there's different effect sizes and there's a range of uncertainty because our knowledge has limits. So that's important, that base data of like, where are risks and how are these risks shifting depending on different choices we make? And the second important thing is like, where is that line that we cross, that threshold for making a decision? When do we choose the threshold for when we're going to do something, when we don't? And on a population level, we can set a threshold. We can say, when you're 10%, we do this action. When you're less than 10%, we don't. But for patients, you know, those things are a little bit more blurry. And I think if we're only looking at our decision thresholds, we can kind of just lump patients together too easily and just kind of treat them too much like someone from a study. And I think being able to better just visualize this data, show them where it's coming from, how their risk is changing, and helping them kind of make decisions for themselves and have those thresholds for when to make the decisions vary based on their preferences. And that's super empowering. And that's kind of the ideal. It's hard to do because we're all stressed for time and a busy practice. And so having websites that kind of do this work for us and makes it easy for us with a couple of clicks to kind of present this information to make the argument and let patients review it to kind of help make their own decisions, it's very empowering.
Yeah, I'm glad you think so. I certainly do. And but then I'm biased because I've been willing him on for years and had some part in his doing this work as his main job, as it were. Now, if we go to diabetes, and I can find it this time, just to conclude with, again, we'll see that it's a question of lifestyle choices before drug treatment. And in fact, the two overlap. He hasn't included smoking cessation here, but of course, that is absolutely essential in diabetes. Probably the most beneficial thing a smoker can do is not control the blood pressure, but to but cut out the smoking. And so, again, a smoking cessation drug, if needed, would probably be more important than adding on some hypoglycemic agent. And moreover, he's gone quite radical here, and he doesn't mention sugar-lowering agents until item number four, because the first thing is statins and blood pressure control, followed by on this chart, ACE inhibitors for those with albuminuria. I'm just saying that because we're running out of time. I'm presenting this website as a new way of thinking, as well as a good aid to chronic disease management in primary care. I think I'll stop there. And what would you like to add, Raj, in terms of the resources that you use as the US equivalent of a GP, a family physician?
That's a great question. So I think for most of us, if you're working in an academic institution, hopefully your institution has access to resources, whether you have UpToDate, Elsevier, others that have available information for things you can hand out to patients, you can do with them. The challenge for us in the US is that we don't have something like the NHS or NICE to put together all our guidelines and have a systematic way of presenting it. So it's very broken. We're often looking at different guidelines. Many of us are not even familiar with different organizations that are writing guidelines. And some of the transparency behind this is not easily accessible. I think online resources people often use will be things like MDCalc or NNT, the Ready to Treat. But even then, I always want to be cautious because sometimes there can be errors and nothing is perfect. And at the end of the day, I think we're still reliant on our own judgment to navigate through this process. There isn't yet one great resource. But I think making a list and tallying and exposing ourselves and reviewing these different visual information aids is good. And as we find things that we like that suit our style of practicing, communicating with patients, hopefully we can get better at doing this.
Yeah, and I think our patients can play their part by fact-checking us and by using these sites themselves, and they can do homework, and we should be open to be contested because our professionalism doesn't consist necessarily in knowing more than the patient, but being able to help them to put it through, to put it together for themselves and to personalize their treatment. And I think this is the biggest challenge of 21st century medicine, as I've probably said before on these podcasts. And yes. I think Julian has done us a great service in moving us towards that. So on that note, I think perhaps we'll call it a day and move on to discuss other topics next time round.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.